insights and analysis continue. Here's Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
Well, it's another one of those days where, gosh, there's hardly anything happening. Just a little impeachment hearing before the House Judiciary Committee. And, of course, we've got big doings here in the state of Utah with what we think will be a special session of our Utah State Legislature just around the corner now within about, what, 8 or 9 days. And although nobody will confirm that, I tried to kind of hammer down the president of the Senate yesterday on is this or is this not going to happen on the 12th of December. And President Stuart Adams said, well, we're thinking that, but nothing is for sure right now because a lot of moving parts are still moving. So we'll talk about that. We're in the middle of the holiday season. Of course, that's a fun time to talk about all kinds of things, including we're going to talk with a forestry specialist who will talk to us about the live cut and the live still root ball tree that maybe you're bringing into your home and how to make sure that, for one thing, if you want to plant the latter after the season, how long can you keep it indoors? What do you need to do in order to have it survive? And for the one that is fresh cut, how in the world do you keep that alive all the way through the holidays? We've had a few of those that have almost lasted, and we always call that a win. And we lived the last couple of days right on Christmas and after with some real sketchy dryness, let's put it that way. I've never had one other than a pinion. If you buy a pinion, they last. Anything else, they always dry out by Christmas Day. But how can you possibly extend the life and lessen the danger to implosion there in your living room? We'll talk about that coming up. Also, Senator Karen Main will be joining us. We're going to talk about that little minor detail tax reform that is bringing about the special session of the Utah State Legislature. And Senator Mitt Romney will join us. Now, lest you think I'm a wimp and I'm just not going to ask him questions about the impeachment, it's kind of an effort in futility right now. And the senators have made it clear that they're just not going to talk about impeachment because, for one thing, it really looks like they're going to end up being the jury on whether or not the president of the United States will be impeached and convicted and thrown out of office. So most responsible senators have kind of shut up at this point, recognizing that they'll fundamentally be on one of the most important jury duties of their entire life. So what are we going to be talking with Senator Romney about? Well, first of all, most of us are aware how hard he's been working on vaping issues, and that's a big deal, especially now as we are searching for a new head of the FDA. We'll talk about some of the questions and some of the things that he has posed to Dr. David Hahn in the course of questioning. We'll get into that. But we're also going to talk about the Foreign Relations Subcommittee that Mitt Romney is the chairperson of, and Chris Murphy, who is from Connecticut, senator from Connecticut, Democrat, is the ranking member. And we'll see what is unfolding with the ongoing protests in that region, some security interests, of course, of the United States of America. And we'll see what witness Mr. Joey Hood has been saying. He is the principal deputy assistant secretary of the Bureau Near Eastern Affairs, U.S. Department of State. So we got a lot to talk about on the program today, and we're going to talk about a really cool thing. I'm trying to do this every day, at least as long as I have seized the chair here, soon to relinquish, by the way, in the middle of next week. But it's fun to look at what some of our communities are doing to get the Christmas spirit going and to help people in their communities. We'll be talking with South Jordan coming up on something they have afoot. But as is the norm, our esteemed producer, Robin Garfield, is here. Toothache well in hand, kind of. I know.
I tossed in the towel. I'm getting a root canal.
We had a lot
Insurance
of nice people.
Be darned.
We had the Oragel suggestion yesterday.
I know. Thank you, everyone.
People are so kind. But
it's like my mouth knew that our insurance had capped out for the year. And it's like, cool, it's December. Let's just throw this toothache at you and see what you do. So I'm not doing Christmas with
you. You're 3 weeks away from... Yeah, but
I'm calling
still,
it. Sorry, kids. You're not getting that pony this year for Christmas.
There you go.
Mama's got to get a new
and
tooth.
You know, normally I joke about moms wimping out, but oh, man. When it comes to your teeth, I never...
Nope.
There ain't no joking about the pain
not,
in your teeth.
I woke up in the middle of the night last night. I thought my face was on fire. So it's time to call it in.
Well, in light of that...
here we go.
Okay.
We've got some headlines. This one caught my eye because I think I've been guilty of this. 38 vehicles have been stolen in Salt Lake City in the last 5 weeks with the keys in the car.
And you took all 37 of them?
38 are in my driveway. Come pick them up.
Yeah.
No, people are leaving their keys in their car.
Know. I have done that. I don't do it normally, but sometimes I will park my car outside of the garage, my truck, and just throw the keys on the seat thinking, well, I'm going to come right back out and pull it in the garage after I haul whatever it is in. And in the morning, I walk out, my space is blank inside the garage, and I go,
uh-oh.
Oh, no. And you open the garage door and you just go, please be there. And then when you open the door of the vehicle, you go, please, I hope not. Although, if somebody really stole things out of my car, they'd get some really eclectic stuff.
Yeah.
Like the claw feet to my antique bathtub
They'll be out of your car tomorrow.
They'll be, hey, I need those.
No, mine would get crushed up French fries from my minivan. Yeah. I always say, bless the person who breaks into my minivan and steals
anything.
Take whatever you
That's
want.
Right. That's right.
Yeah. So, yeah, Salt Lake Police Detective Greg Wilkins says, please don't make it easy for the bad guys.
Yeah.
Don't let your cars warm up in the driveway. Someone walks by, they hop in, drive off.
Yeah. I'm really good about not letting my car warm up. You know, I got over that years and years and years ago.
The air out there, you see today. Yeah.
The air today, and you know how sometimes you'll be driving in it and you don't notice it until you turn. And as I was getting off the 6th North exit, and I always kind of backtrack into KSL, it's always faster, there are fewer lights, less traffic. And as soon as I turned east, I just went, holy cow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I talked with Grant Wayman this morning. He said some of this is fog.
Right.
But a lot of it is inversion.
Yeah.
So don't let your cars idle in the driveway.
That's right.
PSA. Okay. The last two headlines I have are related to each other. Number one, Americans weigh more this decade than they ever have, but fewer adults say they want to lose weight. So we're becoming complicit with our...
You know, for me, it's a perpetual thing. It's just the never-ending, I've got to lose weight thought. Every now and then, I'll catch fire. I don't know what it is. You get in a groove. I've joked about it. I wish I could figure out what it is mentally, physically, whatever it is. I wish I could bottle it, but I don't have that problem right now.
Well, it's usually January 1st. We all wake up and go, okay, now is the time.
I'm eating everything.
Yeah. Well, it's December.
Anyway,
so more people are gaining weight, but fewer say they want to lose weight.
I think at this time of year, your commitment to goodness and your patriotism can be questioned. If you're seriously dieting during Christmas.
Yeah, eat the caramel.
And this and everything else.
And this next story is related.
Okay.
An unusually cold and wet potato harvest season may lead to a French fry shortage in the U.S.
No.
So weight loss may be compulsory next year for me because I have a French fry addiction.
Well, it must be, you know, now, do I eat my fair share? Absolutely. And more. But do you know who is the real French fry freak in our family? It's my wife, Diane.
We should get together because I have a list of the best ones I've had, and I bet she has some good ones I could pick her brain about.
And some of them, you have to say, it's like McDonald's. McDonald's is really good if they're piping hot, but after about 3 minutes, they're done.
No, yeah, they're good out of the window, but you can't let them sit.
Yeah.
So be careful. There might be a teller. There might be a French fry shortage next year. So
French fry
I guess
shortage.
Hoard them, get them frozen.
Can't you just see people hoarding French fries, little packets from Wendy's and McDonald's, and you know?
I'm a big, sweet potato fry house cut. You're not a sweet.
No,
oh, that's right.
No,
we don't
no.
Okay, all right. Well, I love my French fries, so maybe as Americans don't want to lose weight, they will be compulsed into it by not being able to eat French fries.
So, what is your favorite French fry then?
From around here?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, I'd have to think. Hires has great ones.
Ooh, they do.
Those
have
big, thick cut. Crown Burger has pretty good fries
they
over
do.
Here.
They do. Excellent fries.
I like In-N-Out fries, but they have to be hot.
They have to be piping hot, right?
And you have to put the salt on them because they don't, which is good for some people that can't have salt.
After about 3 minutes, though,
those are the ones
too.
At the top of my head.
Yeah.
I'm
not
sure
a lot of shelf life for fries.
No. I have one more quick question that's not a headline related one, but I told you every day I'm going to ask a Christmas question. Doug, right?
Yes.
What is your favorite Christmas song?
Ooh, my favorite Christmas song. Ooh.
I've written mine down.
Oh, man.
I can tell you
which ones are not.
What, you don't like Hippopotamus for Christmas?
You know, if I hear it once, I get a kick out of it. I hear it the second time, you know. Mm-hmm. But the Christmas Shoes. Ugh.
Oh, no.
You know, and that song leads you astray because it starts off kind of cute. Starts off kind of, you know, but as soon as you get to the weepy, And the you just want to.
That's how I feel about the Little Match Girl story in general.
No, that's kind of sad.
It's just the downer ones, yeah.
I know, it's
or the
so sad.
Christmas Orange story. That one always makes me.
You know, I like a lot of the really old school. And years ago, and it was actually my producer at the time, Aaron Wilhelm, who is married to Amanda, and he brought in an old world. This is how the Christmas carols originally sounded. And they played with the old instruments. There was nothing new. If it wasn't available in 1528,
they really old.
Yeah. And some of them were like old beer drinking songs, like God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen sounds like a beer drinking song the way they did it. But He Is Born, I think.
Oh, you know? I'll look
that
up. My favorite, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, sung by Judy Garland.
Right. From which movie?
Meet Me in St. Louis.
There
we go. Yeah. If I had to just pick one song to listen to forever and ever with her voice, that's the one I would do.
Dee loves that movie.
Yeah. I haven't seen the movie in years, but I love the song.
I've told this stupid story before, but pardon me if you've heard it. But very first year that Dee and I were married, we got married in October. And so our first Christmas was December of 1980. And videos were still relatively new. There was in the old ZCMI Center Mall, there was a video store down in the lower level. And there it was on the shelf. It was kind of like little Ralphie's, you know, Red Rider BB gun. And I thought, there's Meet Me in St. Louis. Guess what the price was?
To buy a copy of it.
To buy a copy of Meet Me in St. Louis in December 1980.
I have no idea.
$89.
To own a copy of the movie.
To own a copy of the movie.
Oh, my goodness.
To buy a blank tape was like $22 back in the day.
So you didn't buy it?
Oh, I did.
Oh, you did?
That's the kind of husband.
That's true love.
That's the kind of lover that I am.
That's a beautiful story. Did you watch it that year?
I'm still weeping over the $89.
Do you still have it somewhere?
I think we did. Although I think it may have departed and bitten the dust.
You can sell it on eBay for all of 10 cents now.
For 10 cents. We still have the VCR down in Eureka, though. So we have quite a VCR collection.
Oh, great.
Videotape.
Yeah.
What's your favorite Christmas movie?
My favorite Christmas movie? Oh, Christmas Story. National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. Those are the two we watch. And then every year on Christmas Eve, as we're decorating or wrapping the presents, we gotta go. But my husband and I watch Die Hard after the kids go to bed.
Well, you know, Die Hard is
a very interesting Christmas movie.
It absolutely is. For me, it's, believe it or not, now this is back before Hallmark got on the assembly line. This is back when they got major league stars like George C. Scott and people like that. And Hallmark's version of A Christmas Carol is about as good as it gets.
Oh, have I seen that? Is that the one with Michael Caine? Oh, George C. Scott.
Yeah, Michael Caine was in The Muppets Christmas.
Yes, okay, that's what I'm thinking.
Which is also one of my favorites, by the way.
It is, I'm getting them all. Okay,
so Did I pass the test?
You passed the test, and I
may have continue
passed.
On?
Please continue on. We need you here.
Okay. Go take another Tylenol, okay?
Yeah, right.
Oh, man. When's the root canal schedule?
Friday morning, bright and early.
Ooh, you put on the movie show on headsets and just ignore it.
Oh, that would be great. I'll listen to you soothe me through a root canal, please.
And every time you groan and moan, the poor dentist will think it's your tooth when it's really
it's
the
movie show.
Exactly. All right, Robin, thank you.
Thank you, Doug.
Okay, well, let's take a break. And when we come back, we're going to play some of the, I don't even know what term do you use the word highlights? In something like this, some of the more dramatic, interesting, I don't know, moments in the impeachment hearing today. We will do that when we come back here at KSL News Radio. So good to have you along on the program today, and the testimony continues. The questioning continues from the House Judiciary Committee. Right now, Representative Sheila Jackson Lee, Democrat of Texas, is asking questions of Professor Noah Feldman. We'll continue to keep our ear to the ground on this, but I thought we'd play some of the comments that unfolded earlier. There were four experts on the law that testified this morning, and let's start with Harvard Law Professor Noah Feldman, who talked a little bit about high crimes and misdemeanors.
Now, turning to the language of the Constitution, the framers used the words high crimes and misdemeanors to describe those forms of action that they considered impeachable. These were not vague or abstract terms to the framers. High crimes and misdemeanors were very... The words high crimes and misdemeanors represented very specific language that was well understood by the entire generation of the framers. Indeed, they were borrowed from an impeachment trial in England that was taking place as the framers were speaking, which was referred to, in fact, by George Mason. The words high crimes and misdemeanors refer to abuse of the office of the presidency for personal advantage or to corrupt the electoral process or to subvert the national security of the United States. There's no mystery about the words high crimes and misdemeanors. The word high modifies both crimes and misdemeanors, so they're both high. And high means connected to the office of the presidency, connected to office. The classic form that was familiar to the framers was the abuse of office for personal gain or advantage. And when the framers specifically named bribery as a high crime and misdemeanor, they were naming one particular version of this abuse of office, the abuse of office for personal or individual gain. The other forms of abuse of office to affect elections, and abuse of office to compromise national security, were further forms that were familiar to the framers.
Jonathan Turley also testified this morning and is taking questions now, a professor at the George Washington University Law School. And it was interesting because he said, you know, we're all mad.
I get it. You're mad. The president's mad. My Republican friends are mad. My Democratic friends are mad. My wife is mad. My kids are mad. Even my dog seems mad. And Luna's a golden doodle, and they don't get mad. So we're all mad. Where has that taken us? Will a slipshod impeachment make us less mad? Will it only invite an invitation for the madness to follow every future administration? That is why this is wrong.
Professor Turley went on to talk about lowering the standards for the impeachment of a president.
So I will conclude with this. Both sides of this controversy have demonized the other to justify any measure in their defense, much like Roper. Perhaps that's the saddest part of all of this. We have forgotten the common article of faith that binds each of us to each other in our Constitution. However, before we cut down the tree so carefully planted by the framers, I hope you will consider what you will do when the wind blows again, perhaps for a Democratic president. Where will you stand then when all the laws being flat?
Well, it is interesting because we've seen that over and over where there will be just raving concern about the changes. I think of the quote-unquote nuclear option in the Senate years ago when Republicans were weeping and wailing and gnashing teeth over the fact that the Democrats had dramatically altered things. I can remember Senator Hatch saying that Robert Byrd would be turning over in his grave and how this damaged the most deliberative body in the world. And then... When the Republicans got power, I asked Senator Hatch here on KSL, okay, that was so damaging and terrible for the institution of the Senate. When are you going to change it? And I basically heard crickets. Well, we're, like I mentioned, you know, sometimes the hypocrisy that we see in Washington when the shoe is on the other foot, you know, the same tune is sung. It's almost ridiculous sometimes. Michael Gerhardt, who is a professor at the University of North Carolina Law School, had this to say about not all crimes are impeachable.
Professor Gerhardt, does a high crime and misdemeanor require an actual statutory crime?
No, it plainly does not. Everything we know about the history of impeachment reinforces the conclusion that impeachable offenses do not have to be crimes, and again, not all crimes are impeachable offenses. We look at, again, at the context and gravity of the misconduct.
And Professor Turley, you recently wrote in the Wall Street Journal, and I quote, "There is much that is worthy of investigation in the Ukraine scandal, and it is true that impeachment doesn't require a crime."
That's true, but I also added an important caveat. First of all,
sir, it was a yes or a no question. Did you write in the Wall Street Journal, there is much that is worthy of investigation in the Ukraine scandal, and it is true that impeachment does not require a crime? Is that an accurate quote, sir?
You've read it well.
I hate that when you get that kind of questioning. He wasn't interested in hearing what these witnesses really had to say or any clarification that might go with it. He was nearly there with a hammer and a nail, and he was going to drive it through that board no matter what. That's the thing that drives me crazy, and that's what I've talked about now for weeks and weeks and weeks. I really sometimes look at these individuals. I go, do they even really want to find out the truth other than just nailing down and reinforcing an argument that they have had? Bothers me. Pamela S. Carlin, Stanford Law School professor, you know, had comments as well, and on this one actually brought up Brett Kavanaugh.
If I could just read one quotation to you that I think is helpful in understanding this. It's somebody who's pointing to what he calls a straightforward principle. It is fundamental to the definition of our national political community that foreign citizens do not have a constitutional right to participate in and thus may be excluded from activities of democratic self-government. And the person who wrote those words is now Justice Brett Kavanaugh. In upholding the constitutionality of a federal statute that denies foreign citizens the right to participate in our elections by spending money on electioneering or by giving money to PACs. They have long been forbidden to give contributions to candidates. And the reason for that is because that denies us our right to self-government. And then Judge, now Justice Brett Kavanaugh, was so correct in seeing this that the Supreme Court, which, as you know, has taken campaign finance case after campaign finance case to talk about the First Amendment, summarily affirmed here. That is, they didn't even need to hear argument to know that it's constitutional to keep foreigners out of our election process.
If anybody's keeping score from this morning's four witnesses, three for impeachment, one against, but that individual, it was interesting, he said, I can't remember exactly how he put it, but he indicated he's not a fan of President Trump, did not vote for President Trump, but did not believe that we were in a convicting of an impeachable offense arena. All right. We're just a minute past the top of the hour. Let's go ahead and take a break. We've got much more in store. We'll revisit this. The questioning and the testimony continues, and we'll try to keep you up to date throughout the program today. All right. Coming up next, keeping your Christmas trees alive and non-dangerous. That's coming up next.
More afternoon news and in-depth coverage with Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
I wanted to let you know, in light of playing some of the comments and the testimony and the questions and so on from the House Judiciary Committee testimony this morning, Chris Stewart is not on that committee, but yesterday he and others had a vote on whether to absolutely approve the report that came out of the House Intelligence Committee, and we'll get his take on what that was like, maybe get a little reaction on what's happening here today. And then also, boy, e-cigarettes and the flavors and different things like that, a big issue for our federal representatives, and Chris is on board with the concerns surrounding e-cigarette flavors and proposing the ban. We'll talk with him about that. But I wanted to get into something a little festive. Most of us, up until 3 years ago, we always had a live Christmas tree. It was just kind of a tradition. I was a fanatic. My wife kind of calls me Clark Griswold Sparky, and I'm putting 8 gazillion Christmas lights on a live Christmas tree. It takes me days. My son has kind of followed suit. I saw his tree the other night, and it was pretty Griswoldian too, although beautiful, I have to admit. It's just the number of lights. But we finally kind of sold out. I know, I'm going to blame D. But we sold out, and we got a pre-lit artificial tree. And I have to admit, I do not miss putting the lights on the tree. But I do miss having a live tree. And for those who still do have live Christmas trees, how do we keep them alive, or at least from just flat out dying in our living rooms, in our family rooms? And we have joining us right now Michael Kunz, who is a forestry specialist, on the line with us. And Michael, thank you for taking time to help us. If we're going to put a live cut or a live root bald tree in our home, what are some of the guidelines? Let's go with the more traditional cut tree first. What do you recommend?
Well, that you buy a good tree that's fresh, and you're right, they really are still alive, even though they've been cut off their roots. They're alive up to the point that they become crispy and dry, and then they're not alive anymore. And what you'd like to do is get a tree that is alive when you buy it or cut it, I suppose, because you can cut some trees on certain national forest and state forest lands in Utah. And then you take it home and you do the right things to keep it alive, hopefully, until you take it out the door. And at that point, it's fine if it dies a graceful death. And
yeah.
And there's even things you can do at that point to maybe make you feel better about your decision to buy or cut a live tree. And we can go into that if you want to.
Is that recycling, or what do you do with the tree once it's served its Christmas purpose?
I think there's probably about two things that turn people off, other than, you know, convenience and stickiness and stuff like that
right.
you have to deal with a live tree. I think people who switch to artificial trees, some of them do it thinking they're doing it to help the environment, because after all, here's this tree in their front room that would be on in the forest alive and become big and stately in years to come. In fact, there's hardly any Christmas trees, at least in the western U.S., that would still be a tree if you didn't buy it and take it home, because they're either grown kind of in farm-like settings, a lot of them in Oregon and Washington, and those trees will be cut down one way or another, mm-hmm. and something else would be planted there if it wasn't Christmas trees. And then the trees that occasionally are cut out in the woods in the West, either by you or by somebody who has a permit to cut them and sell them commercially, those trees also, at least if it's the U.S. Forest Service, they only allow certain species to be cut, and only in areas where they know those trees are not the future forest,
right.
like where they're trying to encourage aspen, for example.
We went up one year just outside of Evanston, past Evanston, and up. We were on the Wyoming side of the border, but very close to Utah, and we had the permit to cut the tree. And that's kind of a fun experience. But, you know, I had assumed and I had heard that that was the case, that the Forest Service is very judicious on where they let people go to cut the trees.
Yeah.
Let's assume for a moment we just went and bought our tree off the lot. We're satisfied that all of the needles aren't falling off of it right now. What should we do to make sure that that tree stays fresh for as long as possible the second we get it home?
Yeah. So as soon as you take it home, if you're going to take it right into the house, it's a little different than if you're going to leave it out in the garage for a while. Either way, like within an hour preferably, you should get the cut surface of the trunk into a container of water.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be the stand that you intend to put it in inside, or if you're going to keep it outside for a while, still put it in something, either the stand that it's going to be in when it's indoors, or just some container that holds a fair amount of water and keep that cut surface covered. Ideally, if you're going to put the tree in the garage for a while, and the garage, if it's unheated, is a great place to keep it,
mm-hmm.
you should, when you get it home, if you have a nice sharp saw and it's convenient, cut off just a quarter of an inch or something like that, and then do that again when you bring it indoors. What happens is, as soon as it's taken out of water, it starts to suck up air into the trunk, and then when you put it back in water, if there's a lot of air in the trunk, then it interferes with water uptake.
Wow.
But my wife and I have a done live trees forever. Yeah. And I actually saw a stand and kind of copied it, and it works great. You need a stand that holds a lot of water if your tree is fresh, because it will use a lot of water. Our trees, in some cases, will use a gallon a day. And, of course, there are stands that, when you get the trunk into them, only hold a cup or two of water.
Yeah, I was really surprised with some of those trees
in
our home, how much water they'd suck up. We are almost out of time. I want to get to the people that are trying to keep a tree alive. They have the root ball there. What are the best things that they can do to hopefully be able to take it outside after Christmas or sometime in the future and plant it?
Yeah, just try to keep them inside for less time than you might with a cut tree, like maybe 10 days, something like that, and water the root ball and feel it occasionally to make sure it feels moist. It'll still need to sit in something or it'll make a mess. and then ideally you should already have the hole dug, but that's more for your convenience than the tree.
Right.
One way or another, you have to get a hole dug and get it in the ground.
I was going to ask about that. So the second you're taking it outside after the holiday or when you feel it's time to take it outside, after that short window you talked about, you put it right down in the hole, although it's the dead of winter and cold, and let her rip?
Yeah, there's really no way around the fact that it's going to be a little shocked
right.
by the cold. But if it's the right kind of tree species, which pretty much it always is, then it will be able to handle it. And actually the only thing that will give it trouble is the warmth when it's in the house.
Right. Michael, I so appreciate you joining us today. There are other questions. We may have to have you back again to walk us through some of the tree safety. A very quick question, though. Assuming you've got a fresh tree and you've taken proper care of it, how long will the fresh cut tree last in your home? I've been surprised sometimes with cut flowers how long they'll last, roses or whatever it might be. How long will the tree, let's just assume for a moment it's like a cut rose, you're celebrating a season, you've got it in water, how long should it last?
It should last, well, I'll use ours as an example. My wife would rather not buy them early, but we bought ours from the forestry club up here at USU like 3 days ago. It'll probably come into the house this weekend, and we will succeed in having it still alive and moist probably until the weekend after the first of the year.
Wow, that lasts a long time. Hey, I appreciate your guidance, and thank you for taking the time to join us. Michael Kuntz with us, forestry specialist with the USU Extension Services. Let's go ahead and take a break at this point, and when we come back, we are going to be talking with Congressman Chris Stewart, who is not on the Judiciary Committee holding their impeachment inquiries, although some, I'm looking right now at Jim Jordan, who was one of the interesting folks in the previous event. Well, he's got a starring role in this one, too, but we'll get Chris's take on what's unfolding. Stay with us. Well, it's good to have you along on the program here at KSL News Radio. And we're keeping an eye on the proceedings that are now in the House Judiciary Committee. Not long ago, we were paying very close attention to what was happening in the House Intelligence Committee. And when we were doing that, we invited our 2nd District Congressman, Chris Stewart, who served on that committee, to be on the air with us several times, just to give us a little play-by-play. And yesterday, that committee had an obligation to go ahead and vote on the report on impeachment that was then passed along. And now, of course, we have the House Judiciary Committee taking testimony and asking questions. And Chris Stewart is on the line with us. Chris, thank you again for always being willing to take the call. And tell me and our listeners, what was that like yesterday when in the afternoon in Washington, D.C., you voted on whether or not to approve the report and basically pass it on?
Well, it wasn't very dramatic, Doug. I mean, we've known for weeks that
this would happen, and it happened as we anticipated it would, and it happened in the way that we thought it would. It was a straight party line vote. We offered several amendments. I offered some amendments to the language. I mean, some of it entirely nonpartisan, but they just didn't want to open the process up at all. They were afraid that by allowing any amendments, they would open a Pandora's box. So short of that, it was actually pretty straightforward, and it only took about, 10 minutes.
Yeah, and today we're seeing an interesting exercise right now. Questions are being asked of Professor Pamela S. Carlin. There have been other legal scholars from various areas, University of North Carolina Law School, Harvard, Stanford, and various. And this morning, for those who were keeping score, it was 3-1. But even the person that was arguing against impeachment had this to say about the president. I think we've got that.
I'd like to start, therefore, perhaps incongruously, by stating an irrelevant fact. I'm not a supporter of President Trump. I voted against him. My personal views of President Trump are as irrelevant to my impeachment testimony as they should be to your impeachment vote. President Trump will not be our last president, and what we leave in the wake of this scandal will shape our democracy for generations to come.
Okay. The interesting thing, Chris, that I've noticed, and you and I've chatted about this, I'm just trying to figure out, and unlike many of your colleagues back there, I don't believe they give a hoot about the truth. I really don't, and I'll just say that straight up. I look at the way they question. I look at the way they cut witnesses off. Once the witness has said whatever they had prepped them to say or coached them into saying or quote some article that was written and then cut them off and they say, but wait, no, this is a yes or no answer. That happened this morning. It makes me so angry. And that mantle of responsibility that is on everyone's shoulders back in Washington, D.C., to do what is best for our country rather than just grandstanding, assuring their seat in the United States Congress or making party hacks happy, whatever it might be. I'm not kidding you, Chris. I'm so angry about this because I am in much the position that this previous person is in. I am daily appalled by the President of the United States. I am daily disappointed in his actions. I am daily cowering in the corner, how I'm going to ever explain this man to my newly born grandson. I am daily embarrassed by the position that he puts our country in, representing us as the leader of the free world, the commander-in-chief of the armed forces of the United States of America, and as president of the United States of America. But Chris, I don't know whether he ought to be impeached or not. And I'm so tired of the bloviation and the crap that I'm hearing from these committees in Washington, D.C., it shakes my faith almost to see how few people really want to get to the truth. Now, I'm sorry. That's how I feel.
Yeah. Well, Doug, the thing is about these committee hearings is there's no surprises and there's no quest for the truth in the sense that...
From either side, Chris. From either side. I watch Jim Jordan, who is the pit bull for the Republicans, and... You know, heaven forbid we get his second act on this one. He's not seeking for any truth. He's a vicious prosecuting pit bull who is there to make the points for his party. And it happens on the other side as well. We have the chairman who, you know, just play this kabuki dance, which is nauseating. And then we have the lawyers who are trying to be somewhat. And then we have the pit bulls. And then we have everybody else. And it is such a disappointing exercise. Like I said, if I didn't love this country so much and have overall longevity faith in our goodness and the fact that we will right this ship, this would shake my faith.
Yeah. Well, Doug, I caught you on a bad day, I can tell.
Actually, I think you've caught me on a good day. I think you've caught me on a day when maybe somebody's actually saying how they really feel and how anxious they are for the truth, that they don't like the president, but I don't want him impeached if he doesn't deserve it.
Well, and that's the essence of this question. So if I could, just a couple things. Number one, as I started to say, this isn't a quest for the truth because much of it was already predetermined. But there's very little that are learned in these hearings. Doug, if you look at the, hundreds plus hours that we sat in these the hearings we had on the Intelligence Committee, some in open session, most of them not in open session, down in the basement in the skiff. But we after the first 2 hours, we didn't learn anything new, and it was a regurgitation of the same thing over and over and over again. The second point I would make is this, and I think this is the most important thing that I could say on this telephone call with you, and you've already alluded to it, and that is you may find this president a lot of things. There are some people who love him and support him, and they genuinely do, and they support his policies. There are some people who hate him and want to see him defeated, and I get that as well. But there's one thing that we have to ask ourselves, and that is, as you said, how do I explain this president to my grandchildren? I think there's another question, that is, how do we explain this impeachment to our grandchildren? Because this is what will happen, and this is, in my opinion, incontrovertible, and it is inevitable that if this president is impeached for this, for the reservations that you have alluded to here, my fear is that every president in our future will be impeached, because every president is going to make mistakes. Every president, either by ill will or just because of a sincere mistake along the way, is going to do something that the opposition party is going to determine is impeachable. And our founding fathers were right when they said high crimes, high misdemeanors, and short of that, settle it at the ballot box. Because I promise you, Doug, regardless of who the next president is going to be, whether it would have been Hillary Clinton, whether it might be Elizabeth Warren, regardless of who it is, the opposition party will find reasons to begin impeachment proceedings at some point, and it destroys the foundation of our democracy if every president has that held over their heads. Settle it at the ballot box. We're less than a year away from an election. The American people can decide this. And for many of these people, this has just been what they've been trying to do since this president was elected and since he was sworn into office. And it's a continuation of that. And that's my great fear, is the precedent that it sets is just unsustainable.
Well, I agree with you on some of those things. I really do. I think ultimately the ballot box is the place. But right now, I think many Americans like myself are trying to figure out, because even the president's friends, like in Time magazine, this person who is arguing against the impeachment says, but that's not to say no harm, no foul. That argument does not excuse the evident lack of judgment exhibited by the White House in attempting to spur action by a foreign government outside of proper channels to investigate a political rival. This is the person arguing for the president. Yeah. And we hear that over and over again. And I still, Chris, you know, and see, I would like to think that our elected officials, the people that we have entrusted to act on our behalf in this great republic, would go back with an open mind, would go back with legitimate, meaningful questions, sincerely seeking the truth on our behalf, so we could determine rather clearly, is this an impeachable offense or not? But our Congress is letting us down right now.
Yeah, Doug, I don't know. I mean, I understand your frustration, but I'm not sure that...
If you went into this, Chris, knowing that this is all just a big charade and that the Democrats are going to say this and Republicans are going to say that, what does that say about our United States Congress and the faith that we average Americans, we mere little people back here in the various districts, should have in our Congress?
Yeah. Well, and that's not the only reason that people are skeptical of Congress. And believe me, I hear that all the day, and I share that frustration and that skepticism. And my point here is that I think this outcome was predetermined. I think the Democrats were going to impeach this president regardless. They're searching for the vehicle. They found one. There's no question in my mind when we started our hearings they were going to impeach him. There's no question in my mind, regardless of what these constitutional scholars say, they're going to vote in 2 weeks to impeach him.
And see, Chris, there's no question in my mind that the Republicans are going in and saying, no matter what we hear about this president, we are not going to impeach him. I believe that as strongly as you believe what you just said.
I do, too. As I was just about to say, there's no question in my mind the Senate is not going to remove him. For legitimate concerns that we've expressed here. Look, you may find this offensive, what he's done. It should not be an impeachable offense. It should not jeopardize the future of presidencies by lowering the bar, the threshold of impeachment to this level. But I will say this, Doug, in that this isn't the first time we've been through this exercise. Every impeachment has been partisan to one degree or another. But at the end of the day, the American people figure it out. At the end of the day, the American people will reward or punish the behavior that they see back here in D.C., and I really believe that's true. And at the end of the day, the American people are going to make a judgment in November of 2020. Was this impeachable? Do they think this president should have been removed for this? And everyone at that point, I hope, has read the transcript of the phone call, which is the heart of this whole thing. You can read the transcript. It's 5 pages long. Let the American people make their decision on whether this president should have been impeached and attempted removed from office for that.
Chris, I always appreciate the fact that, first of all, you take my phone call. Second of all, that you're a friend of mine. And third, that I can speak frankly and you can speak frankly with me. And I let you down today because I didn't leave enough time to talk about the e-cigarette flavor issue. Can we have you back at some time soon to do that?
We'll come back and talk about that. Because you know what, Doug? There's more important things and other important things going on in the world and in Washington, D.C. than impeachment.
I'm going to go sit in the corner for a moment. I'm going to play the meditation music here for a while, okay?
Okay.
Chris, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Doug.
Chris Stewart, our 2nd District Congressman, and I have held news hostage now for about 4 minutes over the limit, but I'm a little wound up on this issue. I truly am. I watch this stuff, and I just go, you know, wouldn't you like to think that our elected representatives who are representing each and every one of us, whether you're a Republican, my representative is a Democrat. I'm in the 4th Congressional District. I would like to think, and Ben McAdams hasn't been in either of these hearings or on these committees, but I'd like to think that couldn't we, when it's this big of an issue, actually seek the truth? I want to know. I really do. I want to know. Has Donald Trump committed not only an impeachable offense, but an offense that would warrant a conviction within the, you know, am I the only guy on the planet that really would like to know? Let's take a break. We'll be right back.
More afternoon news and in-depth coverage with Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
Okay, I am now out of the lotus position. I am no longer chanting in the corner with sitar music, and I think we're back on track. And my friend Dave Colley is here. And Dave, I don't think I've ever heard so much buzz amongst every age group, everywhere I went, including within my own family. People were asking me, hey, tell me what's coming up on cold. What's going to happen here? What about this? And I just went, wow, you know, if for me to answer any of those questions, I have to go to Dave.
And, so, you said Dave didn't tell me anything, that jerk.
Well, you know, that was an amazing series. Truly was. And now we have, what are you calling this one?
I mean, this is kind of a season 1.5.
Yeah.
You know, we decided with the 10-year anniversary of Susan Powell being this week that we wanted to do something special to mark that. And at the same time, the investigation that went into the Susan Powell case, her disappearance, and, of course, everything that happened with her husband, Josh, following that, there were pieces to that story that we were still investigating as cold was coming out last winter,
right,
that just took us this amount of time to really get to a place where we could present them in these new bonus episodes.
Are you surprised that we are still where we are at, and this is still, indeed, a cold case?
You know, it is so hard because there are many, many cases that go unresolved. And for whatever reason, the Susan Powell case, I think, really captures people's minds and imaginations because there is that enduring question of what happened to her and where is she? And to know that we're now 10 years out without finality, without any kind of clear answer to that, aside from the very obvious conclusion that I think many people reached that Josh killed his wife. I think it just makes us all ask ourselves, what could have possibly gone wrong in that family to lead us to this point?
It's interesting because both you and I know people that have scoured the desert. They have looked everywhere. I know people that have gone down rather spooky, deep mine shafts looking for Susan Powell, and we just don't know. And you talk about the uniqueness of this. Not only is it just kind of an unsolved, relatively cut and dry, he either killed her or didn't.
Mm-hmm.
This went on and on. Grandparents were involved, everybody. And then his father, Steve.
Oh, man.
I mean, I will never get over that. And then what ultimately happened with the death of the boys and the circumstances under which that happened, and now the prison term of his dad, the death of his dad, this just keeps on going.
Yeah. Susan's parents, we sat down and did a special interview for the 10-year anniversary, and Susan's dad, Chuck Cox, said something which I think is very true, and that this is a Shakespearean story. This is a story about family and how the decisions that are made by parents cascade down to their children across generations. Yeah. It's about how blood is in many cases thicker than water, and how those bonds of, even in a family where you can point at Steve Powell and say, he was grooming his children, keeping them close in almost a, I would say, a conspiratorial way. I mean, they had their little enclave, and it strikes a chord for so many of us. And of course, what we discovered talking about, these new bonus episodes were more insight into the background of Josh Powell. How did he become the man that he was? What were some of the other, aspects to his life? The new bonus episode we just dropped, we look at 10 years of his history of causing these suspicious car crashes to get money out of insurance companies.
Well, a term just came to my mind, the sins of the fathers. Mm. I mean, boy, you think of what Steve cultivated. You think of what Josh not only cultivated but implemented in murders and death of his children and everything else. And my goodness, but a lot of people are really not up to speed on these accidents. Tell us what this is all about.
Yeah, so there was a crash that Josh Powell was involved in about 3 months before Susan disappeared. And it was suspicious for a number of reasons, but I wanted to talk to the driver who was involved. Once I identified him and got in touch, he said, hey, my insurance agent told me there were other crashes. And that led me down this road of discovery. And I ended up finding a man named Bob Powers, who years before Susan disappeared had a crash with Josh Powell. And Josh had made this claim against his insurance. So Bob was quite surprised when we came to him.
Let's go with that sound.
No need to be stopping. There's the clear road way ahead, no stoplights, no stop signs, no right or left turn opportunities. There was no reason for him to be stopped dead center in the middle of the road.
And so Josh had come to this abrupt stop up in Washington. Bob rear-ended him, and Josh ends up getting about $6,000 from Bob's insurance. Bob had never known about it until I showed him a copy of the check that his insurance company cut to Josh Powell.
Really?
Yeah. It was wild.
Oh, my goodness. And how many of these have you looked into?
We have three confirmed for which we have all of the records. Now, that's not to say that's every single one, but it's the three that we can definitively prove, and they're all very similar.
How did you track down the various drivers or victims? Who knows?
It's funny because insurance companies, they keep those records private. There is a database where if they're concerned about fraud, they can share among the different insurance companies. But as a member of the public, I can't just go jump in that database.
Right.
Well, enter Josh Powell. Josh is a man who keeps meticulous records. He scans all of his paperwork. And so every bill from the doctor, every correspondence he has with the insurance company, his own handwritten notes when he's on the phone negotiating, trying to get more money, get scanned, and that ends up in his computer. So, of course, when Susan disappears, the police get his computers, all of those files, they end up in evidence.
Wow.
Yeah.
Has everything been gleaned from Josh and Steve on the computers or so on? And if so, how much of that is available to people like yourself and the press?
you're trying to get me to spill my secrets, Doug?
Yeah.
We will have a lot more to say, I will say, next week about where things stand with the digital evidence in this case. Certainly, there was one encrypted hard drive, which is still a gigantic question mark, and the people who are still today, 10 years later, working to crack that open, we'll get to hear some of their stories.
Dee and I, between the two of us and with me working here at KSL, I have a lot of stuff, stored away. Nothing is encrypted. Nothing is other than whatever security KSL or whatever, server or whatever we have. There is nothing spectacular that I'm squirreling away or protecting out there, and you can't help but wonder what the heck is in that.
You know, it's funny. I've had some insight, and I will say that Josh was somebody who was concerned about his privacy. And certainly, there are reasons why people encrypt things. If I'm going to keep copies of my bank statements and my health records, yeah, it's probably not a bad idea to encrypt those. Now, how many of us actually do it?
Yeah.
Not many.
Yeah.
But there certainly, I think, were things in Josh's digital data that he was concerned about. And he wanted to make sure that people couldn't just get in and see.
Okay, you've sunk the hook. I'm here. I'm in. I'll be listening. So just give everybody the 101 on how to catch cold, so
yep.
to speak.
Yep.
So did I really say that?
Yeah.
That was not intended, but I won't be here all
week. I would make a boomer joke, but that would be
right.
inappropriate.
Oh, but
If you were a subscriber to Cold before, it will just show up in your podcast app wherever you listen. But if you're new to Cold, thecoldpodcast.com, or you can listen on the KSL News Radio app. Those are both great choices.
Hey, I appreciate you joining us, Dave.
Thanks, Doug.
I'm really curious to see what is coming up. All right, let's take a brief break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about something fun for the holidays, something really cool. We've tried to highlight that yesterday since it was, Giving Tuesday. We really chatted about this, but what various communities and various organizations are doing to really fire up the Christmas spirit. That's coming up next. Well, it's good to have you along on the program today here at KSL News Radio. By the way, you can kick off the holiday season with the Festival of Lights sale at Century Lighting in Ogden. Join KSL's Dave Noriega coming up this Friday from 5 to 8 p.m. and light up your home with Century Lighting. It's fun every now and then, especially at this time of year, to talk about the really cool things, great things that people and communities and organizations are doing. And when we heard about Christmas for Kids that is happening out in the South Jordan area and in the Jordan School District, I thought, hey, we need to talk about this. And I appreciate Brian Sinan joining us, who is the president and CEO of the South Jordan Chamber of Commerce. And Brian, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Doug. Thanks for having me.
Hey, tell us what's coming up, especially on the 14th of December.
Oh, it's coming up quick, too. We've got our Christmas for Kids. That's our sixth annual event on December 14th, and we are hoping to help 500-plus students for the Jordan School District shop for Christmas.
This is a great thing. It truly is, because we've all been in situations where you spot the kid or you know the family, and you just know it's going to be a tough Christmas for them. How do you determine which kids are going to go shopping at Walmart?
Well, the school district picks the students through their individual schools, talking to principals and counselors. And these students are strictly middle and high school. So these are students that you don't normally see getting help during the holiday season. So that's what makes it really special.
How are you raising the funds in order to do this? With the is it an effort of solely of the Chamber of Commerce?
No, we work together with the Jordan Education Foundation, and we were talking to businesses and individuals and just getting the word out every day about it. And we are still a bit behind, I might say. So we are still definitely looking for donations to take care of all of these 500 students.
What is the goal? What is the fundraising number?
Well, each student gets $100 to shop with, and then Walmart, who is our host and also partner in the event, is also kicking in another $15 per student. So they'll have $115 to spend. So you're looking at $50,000 that we have to raise for this event, our biggest in history.
Is the goal within reach?
Yes, I think it is. We've got about a week and a half. If we get that last push in there, I think we'll be okay.
Hey, let's remind everybody, whether you live in the South Jordan area or not, whether you have kids in the Jordan School District or not, a lot of folks just want to reach out and help. How do they get the bucks to you?
They can just go on to jefchristmasforkids.org, and that's 4-F-O-R. So jefchristmasforkids.org.
Okay, J-E-F, I guess that's Jordan Education Foundation.
Exactly.
Christmas, and what was it again?
Four, F-O-R.
Four kids.
Kids.
Dot org. Org. And people can make their donations right there online?
They can donate, or they can go on to register as a chaperone, or like I always say, if you're going to do one, it's always good to do both.
Yeah, you know, it truly is not only fun to give the money and know that it's going to such a wonderful cause. And many of us have had this opportunity in some form or fashion where you're actually at the event and you get to see the distribution. You get to accompany a kid. You get to kind of see the fruits of the labor, and it is incredible.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, it's the amazing piece is it's about the students, but the chaperones have just as much of a great experience throughout the event. And I've always said it to me, it's not just about shopping for presents; it's about mentorship. Some of these students might be going down a path they might not want to go down, and they get a positive feeling with the mayor or the chief of police or the fire chief or business leader. It could change a student's mind, which is an awesome feeling to have.
Well, sometimes it's just a great example and somebody just reaching out and doing something nice for you that can make all the difference. Normally, who are the mentors?
Like I said, chaperones. We've got the business leaders. We have city officials. The mayor's there. The police chief. The fire chief. We have residents, educators there. It is the who's who of the South Jordan area and beyond.
Brian, I really appreciate you sharing this with us on the program over the last little while. We've tried to highlight some of the great efforts that are underway, and it's amazing what we can do as a community when we get together. It doesn't take big, huge amounts of money from, you know, a couple of individuals. Boy, if we all just chip in a little, it can make something like this happen. So let's remind everybody, it's J-E-F, Christmas 4, that's F-O-R, kids.org. And you can make your donation there or sign up to be a chaperone, right?
Absolutely.
Hey, thank you so much. And if you wouldn't mind, we'd appreciate an update on this as we get a little closer to make sure we're going to hit the goal.
Absolutely. No problem at all.
Hey, thank you so much.
Thank you, Doug. Appreciate it.
A delight to have the president and the CEO of the South Jordan Chamber of Commerce on the line with us, Brian Sinan. All right, let's take a break here at the top of the hour. We've got another busy hour coming up. Yeah, I know. Last hour was pretty entertaining. We got some interesting comments on our Utah Community Credit Union KSL text line, and that's 57500, by the way. We'll share some of those comments with you on whatever topic you would like. Don't forget, Mitt Romney will be joining us coming up, and we'll also be talking with Senator Karen Main from our state Senate regarding the special session. That's all coming up.
Afternoon insights and analysis continue. Here's Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
I'm so pleased that the minority leader in the Utah State Senate would join us. That's Senator Karen Main. Senator Main, we've talked a lot about tax reform that is happening here in the state of Utah. And we've had some that have tried to just bring it down to a very simplistic thing, that it's not that complicated. All we're doing is we're extending some taxes over here on some of the services, and then we're giving the vast majority of Utahns a tax break on their income tax at the state, and overall, the vast majority of Utahns are going to get a break. And I go, well, wow, that's an awfully big umbrella that's covering a lot of very intricate details here. And I'd be very curious, because there are so many moving parts here, and I've had so many interesting conversations, and some of the people that I usually turn to for some significant clarification have basically, and from some of these individuals, I've never quite heard this response before. They go, well, Doug, it's really quite complicated. And then they'll say there's still a lot of working parts at play. From you, from your point of view, from the minority leader's position, what are you most concerned about or paying the most attention to when it comes to the tax reform efforts here in the state?
Well, have you ever heard of the saying, it's in the eye of the beholder?
Yeah.
So I think it's the beholder and how they vision things. As you know, and I hope you know, from my perspective, and I think I can speak for my caucus, tax on food is something we are tender to, that's really protective for us. And I appreciate the president and leadership putting me on this on the task force, and we worked all summer long. I brought forth the idea of not taxing any of the WIC products, because those are the things you need to live, the cereal and all those things. So we brought things forth. Well, before the committee, what do you think about this? If you're going to do that, maybe we should not tax that product, those products. So that idea we've floated. But we really have an issue, and I, like I say, I think I can speak for my caucus. It's always been tender to Democrats, and we, this is something that doesn't fly with us. And so that's been really hard for us to digest, and I think the polls show that. So that's where we are on that. And I'm going to, we're going to have our meeting on the 9th, and there's two proposals that my colleagues are going to come back with. So I'm hoping that those will be products that we can digest and look at. And maybe there's something new in the new proposals that are coming back to us.
I've heard some explain that what they're hoping to do, they being that nebulous term, that they, rather than kind of using a blunt instrument, I think it was Natalie Gochner who talked to me about this, rather than using the blunt instrument of basically doing away with the sales tax on the what are they called? Perishable foods, foods that you prepare, whatever the term is.
Right.
That instead of using the blunt instrument and basically giving that break to everybody, giving it to Doug Wright, giving it to Gail Miller, giving it to whomever, you know, let's target it and make it surgical to the people that truly need it. And rather than maybe the huge tax loss of revenue, we would be able to target it down and actually do more good among the people that need it with a much, much smaller amount. Could that work?
Well, I think we just talked about in the eye of the beholder, in the eye of the beholder. And I think that, speaking for myself, we talked about, you know, they want to give a tax break at the end of the year for the tax on food. I have a deep concern that those people that don't file income tax, those people that need it, are not going to be in that mix. We're going to tax you for food, and they're going to reward you at the end. I think that people are going to be missed from that. So that's a concern for me. When I first started on the committee, something that was very important to me is take the tax off Social Security, and I appreciate that that's in the mix. I feel that I would change the caps on that, but I think that needs to be done either in this bill or some other bill. I think we need to remove that from our tax structure in the state of Utah. And the other thing is education. I think when you talk to anyone and they say, what do you think Democrats, it's important to Democrats, I think the number one thing, whoever you speak to would say, I think education. And that's what we're looking at. Very concerned about when we start moving monies around. I'm concerned that the monies from the liquor monies that are going to go into the general fund, that will not be protected for those that have free breakfast and for the children that are fed from that. I'm concerned that there's not enough safeguards in those monies that are going to the general fund that we protect the growth, we protect the WPU, those things that are structurally need to be in place for education. I need to be convinced that those things are protected when it goes to the general fund. I know that the appropriations and all the mechanisms we have to protect those, I'm not convinced that they're not secure enough for years coming, you know, 5 years or 10, whatever those years, that those safeguards and roadblocks are not in place. And mm-hmm. I'm very concerned.
Senator Maine, I have been concerned because this wasn't, at least to my knowledge, and I've asked several other people to figure out if I've just been in a vacuum somewhere, but I know when all of this was brought up last year and it was being discussed in the legislative session, it primarily focused on the sales tax on food, yes, but it also really focused on extending the tax on services. That seemed to be the focus, and the idea was that there would be a little decrease here and so on, but the focus was additional revenues because traditional sales tax has become kind of flaky because of the efficiency of automobiles, because of the way we shop now, brick-and-mortar stores basically going away in a lot of cases. But all of a sudden this year, I'm hearing about changing the Constitution of the state of Utah, something that was put in, I believe, in 1930, that would ensure the stability of the money that would go into education by putting the earmark on all of the state income tax going to K through 12 and some for higher education. Now I'm hearing the conversation about changing that.
And I think philosophies, that's where that comes into play. Where do we think education should be, and where do other people think where that should be, how we should fund that? And I think that's what it's down to. Where we have concern that those dollars are not protected, I feel, this is a personal feeling for me, I think earmarks need to be on education and transportation. We don't want half-built roads, and we want to make sure those education dollars go where they need to go, and we're going to change that mix. Will there be good things from that mix? Probably so, but that always in the back of my mind, and those colleagues that I have are very concerned that those earmarks are gone, those roadblocks are gone, and it's going to go into the general fund. Do I trust my colleagues and the people I work with now? Of course. The chairs of those committees, of course. But philosophy changes as time goes on, and different directions of education or transportation. So what we put in place now might, if we don't make it secure, it might change in focus as years goes on. And that's what we're looking at. We just are concerned, and I hope that on the 9th that my colleagues have brought different plans and options for us to look at. But now this is a huge concern. Tax on food, that's always been tender to us. And education, we need to be very watchful of how this changes. And I understand the structural change. We need to move in a different direction, and that's fine. But we started with a whole bunch of services. Now we're dwindled down to a small amount. And probably maybe we need to look closer at the ones that we were taxing, but that puts more stress on the less services that were in that list. And that's more pressure on the food.
Mm-hmm.
So let's hope that we can have some conversation on the 9th and see what kind of product we can come up with. And I'll be very interested in that. And you know, I want to say something. In my circumstance, I have always had conversation with the chairs, with my leadership in the Senate. So I've been given. I can talk to him anytime. We've had conversations. So we might not be in the same page of things, but we've been looking in the same book. So
right.
I appreciate that. And the things that, like I say, the Social Security, that was very dear to me, and they looked at that. And saying that, that should have been done a long time ago. We shouldn't tax Social Security. That puts people in poverty. It doesn't lift them up.
Right. One final thing. Let's get back to education for just a moment. Over the last now quite a few years, and there have been issues, our schools now and so on, that has had a very unique backing of some of Utah's past very powerful political leaders, former speakers of the House, for example, like Nolan Karras, former presidents of the Senate, like Lane Beatty. We have some of the most powerful and the most influential business people in the state of Utah that have been behind Gail Miller, Scott Anderson, and others. You look at the Chamber of Commerce that have actually been working on things that would actually increase the funding for education through a modest increase in the income tax. When I talked with former Governor Huntsman just this past week on TV, we were talking about some of the tax reform. And he was saying, you know, around the country, we're kind of right where we need to be on taxes right now. He said, I can't recall exactly, and I certainly don't want to put words in his mouth, but he said, we have a very favorable image when it comes to the income tax and business taxes and things like that right now. And alluding to the fact that we're in a pretty good place, and we're talking about reducing taxes in certain areas rather than what our schools now advocated. And that was a bipartisan organization with, as I mentioned, some pretty heavy-duty Utahns behind it. And I don't know how we've kind of gotten now to the point where we lower the income tax and maybe put more of the burden on funding. And again, we haven't seen the final draft. We don't know exactly what it's going to be. But, boy, there are sure rumblings out there. about the idea of maybe transferring some of the responsibility for funding education at the, this is the term that's used, the local level. Now, what in the world does that mean other than what are we going to do locally? I mean, I think of an organization like the Granite School District that goes from the Ochre Mountains to the Wasatch Mountains. It goes through I don't know how many different municipalities and non-incorporated areas and everything else. Other than property tax, how would you ever make up that deficit?
I think you said it. What in the world does that mean? I mean, we don't know. And that's where, you know, the journey gets kind of muddled. And that's what we're concerned about. People understand income tax. They might not like it, but they understand it. They don't understand tax on services. This is a new journey for them. And I think that that's, we're moving the structure or trying to move it in a different direction. I was just at one of my Rotary meetings just a few minutes ago, and that was the conversation. We understand income tax, but services over here, that's mm-hmm. kind of muddled for us. And then we're getting from the internet dollars that we're getting, those Amazon dollars, those things are coming into play. If people understand that, and those tax dollars are coming our way. So I think that's the journey, and that's always been the struggle. We're going to change the structure. Yeah, I get that, and that probably needs to happen. But on the other hand, is it now? Do we go? Is it today? Is it when is it? Is the house on fire or the house just not on fire? And I think that's what we're looking at. And hopefully, you know, we'll see what's going on the 9th. And we have, and, you know, it's not a go-go for us for a special session, but we've got it on our calendar. So that's the powers that be will govern that. And, you know, coming back to what I, the conversation, education and tax on food. Those have always mm-hmm. been dear to us. And those are the two things that we're looking at.
I talked with Senator President Adams yesterday and tried to pin him down a little bit on whether or not for sure this was going to happen on the 12th. And he would not commit to that. He said that, you know, they're working toward that, but there are all kinds of things in progress. And so I think everybody's planning on the 12th, but at least from my point of view, and maybe you can enhance this a little bit, is it going to happen on the 12th?
Well, you know, you talked to the president, and I think that's pretty high up. And he's the one that says we're going. So he's the leader of the band in the Senate. So whatever he chooses to do, then we'll be there.
Senator Maine, I always appreciate our conversations. Thank you. We'll watch the 9th very closely. And if the special session occurs on the 12th, we here at KSL News Radio will be watching very closely.
I appreciate your time, and thank you so very much.
Thank you. Senator Karen Maine, she is the minority leader on Utah's Capitol Hill in the Senate. A lot of interesting questions here. And, you know, I appreciated what Senator Maine said. She said, you know, she trusts her colleagues. I trust them, too, that they are trying, sincerely trying to do the right thing. They've got a lot of balls in the air. A lot of juggling is going on right now. There is no perfect solution. I think we all get that. And I think while the intentions are good, I just really hope that we take the deep breath. I know my friend LeVar Webb at Utah Policy, whom I have great respect for, said, hey, we've studied this to death. This is the time for action. It's time to finally move forward. And I agree with that to a point. But, man, you know, you've got to have a good action plan, and you have to get this one right. I mean, it's not the end-all and be-all. Things can be corrected, but wow, I don't know. There are just so many parts of this that that I hope that the minds immeasurably superior to mine understand, because I'm still slightly, it's a little murky to me. And when I hear people that I greatly respect, like Karen Maine, like Natalie Gochner, like others that we've talked to on the program, saying, well, it's complicated. Well, that's still a little murky. Well, I don't quite know. You kind of go, wow, okay. Well, I hope we can put that together here in the next couple of days. Let's take a break, and we will come right back with more here at KSL News Radio. Don't forget, we'll be talking with Senator Mitt Romney coming up at 2:35. Before we take a break at the bottom of the hour here in a couple of minutes, I wanted to set the stage for a conversation that I hope we can have, you and me, on our Utah Community Credit Union KSL text line. And you can also leave your comments, of course, on our voice message line. You can call 575-7668. And I'd like to ask this question for those who heard the exchange with Congressman Chris Stewart. I'm really frustrated, and I am not a fan of President Trump, as many of you know. Daily, he disappoints me, if not, you know, appalls me, and I've been very open about that. But I don't. Honestly, at this point, if somebody said, do you think he's done something impeachable that is worthy of conviction? He's already impeached, but worthy of conviction, I'd say, boy, I'm leaning that way, but I honestly don't know for sure. Is this an impeachable offense? And I have gained so little from our representatives on the committees, but I have gleaned a lot. And if you listened, and I can only imagine if we actually had some, you know, other than the pointed comments and the comments that were already designed to get a particular response or just getting them to quote themselves once again with no chance to elaborate on anything. In other words, if we actually had meaningful, sincere questions coming from the committee, I wonder what more we could have had from these people that have been brought forward to testify. And if there was any kind of bipartisanship on this, even if the Republicans said, hey, look, we really don't believe that our president should be impeached, much less convicted, but let's really find out what's going on here. I mean, I know I'm in fantasy land here, but imagine what we as the American people might have learned rather than this kind of train wreck debacle that we have seen. But I would be very curious from you. Do you, at this point, in what you've heard, not just from maybe your favorite talking head, but from the actual witnesses, do you believe that the president has committed something that is worthy of conviction in the impeachment? The impeachment's already happened, but what about the conviction? I'd like to hear from you on our Utah Community Credit Union KSL text line at 57500. Have you heard things that make you feel that he should be convicted or not convicted? I want to hear from you. We'll take a break. We'll be right back with Mitt Romney.
The afternoon insights and analysis continue. Here's Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
Boy, so many things to talk about with Mitt Romney and so little time. Senator Romney, thank you for joining us here at KSL.
Thank you, Doug. Good to be with you again.
Let's talk about what's been happening in the Foreign Relations Subcommittee that you are the chair of and Chris Murphy is the ranking member. What has been on the discussion docket regarding our U.S. policy in Iraq and in Lebanon?
Well, I think the whole world is watching what's happening in those two countries, as well as in Iran. And for that matter, in Hong Kong, you have demonstrations and protests going on. But in Iraq, for instance, several hundred people have been killed as government troops and perhaps even some Iranian militias have fired on peaceful demonstrators and killed people. In Lebanon, again, you've got large numbers of people protesting. Interestingly, in both Iraq and Lebanon, as we heard today in our hearing, there is a strong anti-Iran sentiment. The people in Lebanon, as well as those that are in Iraq, are feeling that Iran is playing too heavy a hand in their country. They're concerned, of course, about corruption and high levels of unemployment as well. But all of those features are coming together, and people want to see leaders that are not corrupt, leaders that are building an independent, strong nation, leaders that are not willing to be subservient to the Ayatollahs in Iran.
Obviously, when we talk about Iran in this part of the world, there are so many things for the United States and others to be concerned about and certainly aware of. I understand that you are looking into the issue of recent holds on U.S. military aid to the Lebanese armed forces. What did you discover on that?
Well, it's very interesting today. We asked a member of the State Department specifically about the hold on the funding, and he said it was not the result of a policy decision by the State Department or the White House to withhold funds, but it instead was a bureaucratic process that requires time to be able to sort through and provide the funding that the Lebanese armed forces need. We provide approximately $105 million to the Lebanese armed forces. This is a group of military personnel that is, in many respects, the alternative to Hezbollah, which is the terrorist organization funded by Iran. And so it's important for American policy, at least I think most of us on our committee felt, for us to get the money as quickly as possible to the Lebanese armed forces so that we can keep Hezbollah from playing an even greater role there. But the people in Lebanon are in the streets protesting too much influence from Iran. So this is an opportunity for the Lebanese government to stand up and play a more assertive role in keeping Iran from playing a malign role in their nation.
Senator, in just the brief moment we have left, you've had such a focus on vaping issues and the candied flavors and so on. I thought it was interesting today that Minnesota has filed a lawsuit against the Juul company on some of these very issues regarding vapor. And boy, it was interesting to see the response. Boy, when that was announced back in Minnesota, all of a sudden there was a lot of applause. You have been in the situation of being able to ask questions of Dr. Stephen Hahn, his nomination to serve as the FDA commissioner. Do you have a friend in Dr. Hahn if he is confirmed?
You know, I sure hope I have a friend in Dr. Hahn. I'm typically in awe of people who have graduated from medical school, and in his case, a very esteemed practitioner of the medical arts. And so I believe that someone who's taken the Hippocratic Oath as well as the oath to our Constitution is a person who will be inclined to do what's in the best interest of the American public health. And not inclined just to bow down to political pressure, because I can assure you, Doug, there is enormous political pressure, and it's mostly on my Republican side of the aisle. There's a lot of pressure from Republicans to say, hey, let's just keep on letting people vape with these flavors. And in my view, they've got to stop and say, wait a second, it's one thing for adults to be vaping, but it's another thing for 5 million high schoolers across this country to becoming addicted to nicotine. So I hope what you're going to see is that Dr. Hahn will ultimately do the right thing with regards to outlawing packages that could be contaminated, as many have that are vaping, as well as flavors. But if he is unsuccessful in doing that, or if he's directed to not do that, I hope he will come out and explain where this direction's coming from. And I also anticipate that Congress will be able to act with specific legislation which will get rid of these flavors itself. And by the way, Governor Baker of Massachusetts signed a piece of legislation just this last week saying they will not allow any flavors, menthol included, no flavors in vaping products in Massachusetts, and no menthol cigarettes either. I mean, they're saying, look, why are we making it easier for people to kill themselves?
Senator, one quick question. Did you find a sympathetic ear with the president when you brought this up at lunch?
You know, we had the president called people on both sides of this issue together, including the executives at Juul and other companies and a number of people from health organizations. And this was a listening opportunity for the president. He did not show his hand on this as to what he was inclined to do. He asked for various viewpoints. I have expressed mine to the president, and I also wrote a letter to the president responding to additional questions that he had. I'm making sure that the White House understands where, at least where I stand, and of course I made it very clear to the new FDA commissioner, Dr. Hahn, that he understands where I stand and where others of us stand, and we're going to keep battling on this because I know it's an inconvenience for some adults who've gotten used to flavors in their vaping products, not to be able to have those flavors. But you have to weigh that against millions of young people getting hooked on nicotine. And by the way, I should just note that the Juul company, I mean, you mentioned them, the Juul company has stopped selling flavors. Other than menthol, they stopped all the other flavors because they recognize that they're just impacting a lot of our kids. And this This is a real epidemic, and the idea that we're going to have millions of American young people getting hooked on tobacco products, in many cases unknowing on their part. They don't even know these things have nicotine. This is really unthinkable.
Senator, thank you so much. I appreciate you sharing your time. I'll look forward to a chat again soon.
Thanks, Doug. All the best.
Senator Mitt Romney with us here at KSL News Radio. All right, let's take a brief break, and when we come back, we're going to recap a little bit of what is still unfolding. There, of course, was the noon recess. There was a short recess a few moments ago in the House Judiciary Committee, where the impeachment discussions continue, this time with constitutional impeachment experts, law scholars from various universities. We'll give you a little recap coming up. Stay with us. Thank you for being along with us here at KSL News Radio. Interesting day. Had the chance to chat with some very interesting people. Michael Koons, that was, you could tell he was just really into this, keeping your Christmas tree alive, whether it's a live tree with a root ball on it or whether it's a live cut tree, keeping it healthy and safe within your home. I appreciated him joining us. And Chris Stewart, sincerely. Chris and I have been friends a long, long time, and we speak fairly frankly to each other, publicly and privately. And I just kind of got wrapped up, and I'm glad I did on this. I'm so sick of just the show that our representatives are putting on in both the House Judiciary Committee today. Although I haven't had a whole lot of time to watch and listen to that today, but some of what I did hear, I thought, well, you know, okay, this is just basically what we saw in the House Intelligence Committee, and this time they're questioning legal scholars and constitutional law professors from various universities, and I can't help but wonder. And several people have responded, not many though, because it's a tough question, isn't it? I've asked the question, and maybe I ought to phrase it this way: if you were in a position today where you had to vote on convicting the president in this impeachment process, in other words, if you had a vote in the United States Senate, how are you leaning right now? How are you leaning? I would lean slightly toward, but if you asked me right now, today, I couldn't vote for impeachment. I'm not convinced yet that there have been impeachable offenses convicted, you know, to be convicted of. And that's hard for me to say because, like so many people, including some who testified today, as a matter of fact, do we have that sound? I wanted to hear this. This is the one person that stepped up. It was Professor Turley who stepped up and did support the idea of not impeaching the president of the United States. But boy, he did that with some interesting disclaimers as well, as quite a few people have done, whether they're writing articles or whether they are testifying. Listen to what Professor Turley had to say.
I'd like to start, therefore, perhaps incongruously, by stating an irrelevant fact. I'm not a supporter of President Trump. I voted against him. My personal views of President Trump are as irrelevant to my impeachment testimony as they should be to your impeachment vote. President Trump will not be our last president, and what we leave in the wake of this scandal will shape our democracy for generations to come. I'm concerned about lowering impeachment standards to fit a paucity of evidence and an abundance of anger. I believe this impeachment not only fails to satisfy the standard of past impeachments, but would create a dangerous precedent for future impeachments.
Can we also hear the sound, since he mentioned we're all angry, and I think everybody is angry right now. And I think, honestly, the anger has been cultivated, not by one party or another, but by both parties. I think that we have, I hate to use the word played, but they're cultivating our anger. They are basically cultivating and creating division. And it so distresses me. And Jonathan Turley, who is the professor at George Washington University Law School, and he's the one who ultimately is saying, hey, no, no, we should not impeach the president. Was it not, this was Turley who said this, and it was, we're all mad. We'll play that in a moment, but I understand we have some breaking news, and I've been hearing some rumblings about this. And we are joined now by Mark Juke. And Mark, what's happening out there on Redwood Road?
Well, Doug, sadly, we've confirmed one person dead. This is actually in Taylorsville on 4700 South and about 19th West, so just west of Redwood
Road. Just west
of
Redwood
Road. This was a house fire and a roof collapse. So one confirmed dead there. Unified Fire, Unified Police are on the scene. Unified Police confirming that fatality. We also have a reporter en route there, and we will bring you those details and these details as they develop.
Boy, do we have any word of any others injured or anything? Just the confirmation?
Not at this point. We've heard a lot of traffic around that, and right. We're just working to confirm that. But we are, again, sadly able to confirm that one fatality. There was a fire there and a roof collapse. And Unified Fire, Unified Police there and responding to the scene. So.
Okay, we'll look forward. We'll anticipate the updates on that. Our Mark Juke bringing us that news. I mentioned that Jonathan Turley, of the four people that testified and took questions today in the House Judiciary Committee, he is the only one, although he gave some disclaimers. He said, I'm basically not a fan. I did not vote for the president. We are all angry. Let's hear the part where Jonathan Turley talked about, we're all angry.
I get it. You're mad. The president's mad. My Republican friends are mad. My Democratic friends are mad. My wife is mad. My kids are mad. Even my dog seems mad. And Luna's a golden doodle, and they don't get mad. So we're all mad. Where's that taking us? Will a slipshod impeachment make us less mad? Will it only invite an invitation for the madness to follow every future administration? That is why this is wrong.
That is a concern. That is legitimate. Chris Stewart mentioned that. I've heard others mention that, ironically, on both sides of the aisle, that we can't let this be the norm. We can't be impeaching each and every president unless, in other words, weaponizing the impeachment process. If it's legitimate, you're darn right. That's why the Founding Fathers put it in there, the opportunity to rid ourselves of a truly despicable person who is president of the United States. So far, we have yet to do that. Odds are we would have done that with President Nixon. But we tried back in the day with Andrew Johnson. It was tried with President Bill Clinton. And I think none of them, they were impeached, but they were not convicted. I think President Nixon probably would have been convicted of impeachment. I thought it was interesting what Noah Feldman, who is a Harvard law professor, had to say as he worked to really define what indeed high crimes and misdemeanors mean and meant to the founders.
Now, turning to the language of the Constitution, the framers used the words high crimes and misdemeanors to describe those forms of action that they considered impeachable. These were not vague or abstract terms to the framers. High crimes and misdemeanors were very... The words high crimes and misdemeanors represented very specific language that was well understood by the entire generation of the framers. Indeed, they were borrowed from an impeachment trial in England that was taking place as the framers were speaking, which was referred to, in fact, by George Mason. The words high crimes and misdemeanors referred to abuse of the office of the presidency for personal advantage, or to corrupt the electoral process, or to subvert the national security of the United States. There's no mystery about the words high crimes and misdemeanors. The word high modifies both crimes and misdemeanors, so they're both high. And high means connected to the office of the presidency, connected to office. The classic form that was familiar to the framers was the abuse of office for personal gain or advantage. And when the framers specifically named bribery as a high crime and misdemeanor, they were naming one particular version of this abuse of office, the abuse of office for personal or individual gain. The other forms of abuse of office to affect elections, and abuse of office to compromise national security, were further forms that were familiar to the framers.
We had two other professors who were testifying and making statements and answering questions today. One was Pamela S. Carlin, Stanford Law School professor, and it was interesting, and we won't play this, we don't have time, but she was actually quoting Brett Kavanaugh, who now, of course, is on the Supreme Court. And Kavanaugh upheld a statute that denies foreign citizens the right to participate in our elections by spending money. And he said at that time, that denies us the right to self-government. And then judge, now Brett Kavanaugh, was so correct in seeing this, she said. And we won't have time to play the soundbite from Michael Gerhardt, who is a professor of law at the University of North Carolina School of Law. But boy, not only did he have some strong things to say, he said this. Are you ready for this quote? The president's serious misconduct, including bribery, soliciting a personal favor from foreign leaders in exchange for his exercise of power and obstructing justice in Congress, are worse than the conduct of any prior president. Yeah, we're going to keep an eye on it all. We'll see you back here tomorrow.